the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Well, one of the things that we've seen this year with the outbreak of COVID is how different states have handled it in terms of lockdowns and what it has meant for the economy. But there are other things that are going on within the states, within the country. Some are doing better than others. Some are more competitive. And that's the topic of today's show. Joining me on the program is Jonathan Williams. He's chief economist at ALEC. And you guys just published a report recently called Rich States, Poor States. And what really surprised me, Jonathan, and maybe we can get into this, is the top states for competitiveness, and I'd like you to define what that is Utah, Wyoming, Idaho, Indiana, and North Carolina. So a lot of these states in the top 10 are not really some of these big blue states like California, New York, Illinois. So let's get into that. What went into this survey and what determines the ranking?
Well, thank you first for having me on your show, and greetings from the land of make-believe out here in Washington, D.C. We put together this Rich States, Poor States report now for the last 13 years, and we wanted to show states really the ability to compare themselves. We operate in these 50 laboratories of democracy, of course, and we want states to compete with each other for job creation and people moving from state to state. And so while we could certainly come up with probably 1,000 different ways to measure state competitiveness, we decided to focus on 15 factors. And we focused on those 15 for a couple of major reasons. First of all, based on studying the data, and we know what works and what doesn't when it comes to policy and which policies really matter for growth. So taxes and regulation and labor policy, those are the broad categories that we measure. And that's something that Art Laffer has followed for now 50 plus years. And we know that they move the needle when it comes to why some states succeed and others don't. And then the other real reason, this should kind of go without saying, is it's because state lawmakers actually control these variables, and they can alter the course of their competitiveness in their state capitals each and every one of their state legislative sessions, because there's some reasons why some states do very well, weather and access to deep water ports and tourism and many other things that state legislators would love to be able to legislate. A little warmer weather maybe up in Michigan in the winters where I'm from, but obviously they have to focus on the things at hand and policies they absolutely can control. And so we found some fascinating results across the 50 states over these last 13 years. I've had the opportunity to be physically in every one of the 50 states working with our members. And I think the results are truly overwhelming to show that policy matters, and states that value free market, lower taxes, economic competitiveness are the states where people are voting with their feet, as we like to say, every single year and moving to those states.
You know, one of the things that we've seen, and this goes along with your survey in terms of ranking, some of the states that have been hit hardest with COVID and also more severe with their lockdowns happen to be some of the states that are on your bottom of the list. I'm thinking of New York, California, some of those states. So how much has the lockdowns and the way states have handled it contributed to this survey?
Well, first of all, you know, I would not want to be in the shoes of any governor this last year. This is not certainly for the faint of heart, and they were making some real decisions that had to make trade-offs in some cases between health and people's livelihoods, and those are very difficult value judgments. But certainly, you saw a very different tact from governors. And I do think it should be restated, because the mainstream media doesn't talk about this nearly enough, is President Trump deserves, I think, a whole lot of credit for allowing states to make these important decisions around public health and around their economies. They're, you know, in the face of withering pressure, he resisted the calls for national mandates and lockdowns. And I think that was great to allow the principle of federalism to work. And then, of course, it empowered the men and women who serve as chief executives of the 50 states to make decisions they thought were in their best interest. And it turns out, of course, now that we have the benefit of time, we can go back and look to say, was that the right decision? Was it the wrong decision? And what kind of consequences do we have coming out of those decisions? And certainly, I think you can draw a pretty interesting connection to the states that did have the most extreme lockdown measures, and the states that, of course, have not bounce back economically, that have some of the most stubbornly high economic unemployment rates, for instance, right now. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, as you may have seen, just came out with the state-by-state numbers for September. And, you know, there's a huge difference. I mean, this chasm between Nebraska at a 3.5% unemployment rate, where Governor Pete Ricketts was one of the very first to try to reopen the economy in a safe way and reopen people's livelihoods. And then you have at the other end of the spectrum, states like Rhode Island and New York and Hawaii that had very fierce lockdown measures. And of course, some of those states have had very bad anti-market policies in place for a long time on top of it. And so you do absolutely see this difference of governing play out when it comes to the economic numbers and how states are recovering from the pandemic and the economic downturn.
So when you look at these states and that are, let's say, have gone through more severe lockdowns, New York, California, one of the things that we're also seeing, and I'm just going to give our own state of California, the government can always print money. They can run budget deficits. States are required to balance their books. They can't print money. So as they lock down their economies more, they put more businesses out of business. Unemployment goes up. Their tax revenues fall down. And yet, Jonathan, you have a state of California. They're proposing a wealth tax. We have the highest income tax rates in the country at 13.3. They're talking to raising them to 16.8. They are raising taxes on commercial property at a time commercial property is suffering because of lockdowns and COVID. You would think they would know better, but that's not what they're doing. They're actually making matters worse.
Well, and, you know, if this last decade hasn't been kind of the time where the day of reckoning comes for California, and you've seen the massive outmigration of individuals and businesses over this last decade, where, as you know well, California is down net now about 800,000 Americans moving to the other 49 states. And of course, that is a huge cause of budget shortfalls when you have your tax base get up and become the tax base of Texas and Florida and Tennessee and Colorado and Arizona and many of the competitive states across the country. And doubling down on that strategy would be absolutely economic malpractice for the state of California. You know, obviously, whether it's the budget issues that will be persistent, but continuing to drive away productive members of society and entrepreneurs and businesses, whether it's this issue of eroding Prop 13 property tax protections on commercial properties, the wealth tax idea, which I think chasing people after they've left the state is clearly almost admitting you've got a real problem if you're trying to tax out-of-state residents. I think that would be immediately stopped by the federal court system. But I think California, unfortunately, has become the epitome of what not to do as a state when it comes to policymaking. And now you're seeing the results. And for those that may not care as much about the economics and care more about the politics of it, let's just look at what probably will happen after the 2020 census wraps up. And California is very likely to lose its first ever U.S. House seat because of this vast outmigration out of California. First time since statehood near 1850, California is going to lose representation in the United States Congress, likely because of this outmigration effect.
Has COVID accelerated this migration trend that you're seeing? I know, you know, when you talk to realtors here, they're telling about, you know, they've never seen so many people put their homes up for sale and leave. You know, they're going to Nevada, Arizona, Texas, some going to Florida, but they're going to low tax states. And that was a trend that was in place over the last couple of years. And especially I see this, Jonathan, with the retirement age group where people are leaving expensive states like California, selling the home, and moving to places like Arizona and Nevada. So has COVID accelerated this trend as a result of lockdowns and the way states are dealing with them?
Well, I think a couple of things have accelerated that trend, but I think absolutely as businesses seen their livelihoods evaporate because of government lockdown orders that have been overly aggressive, as individuals retire, as you mentioned, they're looking for a better quality of life at a lower cost of life. and they're looking at states, let's say, without income tax on pension income and retirement income, investment income. If we look at the nine states that, for instance, go without a personal income tax, like Nevada, like Tennessee, Florida, Texas, some of the big in-migration states, and those states are booming. You talk to real estate agents in a lot of those places, like I have, and I'm sure you have as well, and they are literally busting at the seams in a lot of those cities. And you look at even up north in Oregon, where a fairly high tax state on income taxes. However, many Californians have realized that, hey, they don't have a sales tax in Oregon, first of all, and overall property costs are lower. And so Californians are even flocking to other high tax states that are relatively lower tax than California. And so that has accelerated, I think, because of the lockdowns and because of the pandemic. But on the other hand, another kind of untold story here is because of federal tax reform. This is something, of course, Speaker Pelosi and others have complained about broadly, but because of the Trump tax reform, it did away with, some would say, a subsidy to high tax states, the state and local tax deduction, which had previously been unlimited. It capped that at $10,000 per year, and that then raised effective tax rates at the state level because individuals couldn't write those exorbitant tax burdens off on other taxpayers around the country in terms of the federal income tax. So you have that phenomenon, and then you have the COVID situation here. And let's not forget Silicon Valley, Manhattan, lots of high cost of living areas for employees that now employers are saying you can go work remotely from wherever you'd like for all of 2021 in a lot of cases and maybe beyond. A lot of people are just looking for better value for real estate and are seeing a huge uptick in out-migration from those high cost of living areas overall.
So, you know, you're an economist and you advise states, you advise people on economic policy. I can't help but believe, don't these states and some of these governors, whether it's New York, California, have economists that are telling them, hey, these policies are driving your tax base out of the state, which means you're going to raise taxes, but you'll actually get less tax revenues.
Well, you would think so. And especially in a place like New York, where you had former Congressman Jack Kemp, really a supply sider that understood the Laffer curve effect. When you raise tax rates, you get many times lower revenue than you would have gotten otherwise because of this tax base effect of people voting with their feet and businesses deciding to take profits in states outside of high tax states. Of course, California should realize that, having Governor Reagan being a fixture. And of course, Art Laffer spending a lot of time out in California, former resident of San Diego down by you. And so those states, unfortunately, just never seem to grasp this phenomenon. They always think that some central government decision will create jobs. I mean, you hear this a lot in the national news and the presidential race and a lot of the races across the country, is there's that prevailing thought that government just creates wealth. And of course, we know that it doesn't. There's no such thing as a free lunch, as the great Milton Friedman would say. And states, unfortunately, failed to learn that lesson. It's really unfortunate. You would think year after year, decade after decade of out-migration and the losses of economic power from those high-tax states to states that are more competitive, you would get governors that understood that phenomenon, but I just don't think that they do in a lot of cases.
Well, you know, you would think you would have to take notice, especially with the census results. I think last year we lost over 100,000 taxpayers or more in California. You would think that if they lose a seat in the House of Representatives, they might want to rethink what they're doing, but it doesn't seem to get through.
Well, and that's a really interesting phenomenon, that California may lose its first ever seat since statehood because of the out-migration. New York has gone down that road for a long, long time, and they will probably lose at least one more, if not two, after the 2020 census. But if you go back several decades, I mean, we're talking a situation in New York where they've lost 10 or 12 or 15 congressional districts on net during the last 40 or 50 years because of the out-migration effect. And that has not changed the course of policy, unfortunately, around New York. And a lot of times what they do is, I guess, they complain about businesses that leave, that they're not paying their fair share, or somehow it's a greedy business that doesn't want to contribute to the community. And the other thing that they do, unfortunately, this is a prevailing, I think, thinking around those states, is, you know, if we have a budget shortfall, that's okay, because if we get the right set of characters in Washington, D.C. at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and in the Capitol building, they'll just send us a bailout check and we don't have to pay these exorbitant benefits that we've promised on pension income and health care and all the other promises that those big government states have done. And they just want to socialize their costs off to rest of the hardworking taxpayers around the country to say, we all know that you balance your budgets every year and we don't, but for some reason, we think it's fair for you to come out and bail out our big government states. And that's, of course, the debate that we've been waging here in Washington this entire year.
Well, it's kind of interesting, but, you know, the government is operating under the assumption, MMT, that, you know, as long as you issue debt in your own currency, you can run these budget deficits. The Fed monetizes them, but the states can't do that. So how much longer can these kind of policies be sustained at the state level? Because state budgets, you know, states can't print money. So unless you get somebody in the White House that says, hey, doesn't matter that you're fiscally irresponsible, we'll take care of it and just print and send you checks.
That is a great question. I get asked that question a lot. Well, thank God, first of all, that we do have to balance budgets at the state level and states can't print money, or we'd be in much worse shape than we are at the state level. Now, as you know well, some state balanced budget requirements aren't hardly worth the paper that they're printed on, because there's just no teeth there to enforce things. And, you know, we see California and New York and Illinois flaunt those all the time in terms of a meaningful balanced budget requirement. But at least there has to be some motions gone through to show that you're working on it at the state level. I do think, as a Michigan native myself, as I mentioned, you know, we have had, and you have in California, a string of very precipitous municipal level bankruptcies in the city of Detroit, in San Bernardino, in Stockton, other cities across the country that have reached that tipping point that had promised way beyond their means when it comes to usually pensions and healthcare liabilities were some of the leading items there. Of course, we saw this play out in Puerto Rico because of debt issues and liability issues. Now, currently, as many of your listeners know, there's no provision in the U.S. Constitution for state bankruptcy or in bankruptcy law. However, I think that's going to be a big discussion of what happens when, let's say, in Illinois or Connecticut or New Jersey just doesn't make its payments on debt. There may not be a formal proceeding, but there may be some sort of a default if we fast forward and if these issues are not addressed. And so I think that is one of the biggest kind of existential discussions around municipal and state finance is, what do we do as a state and local and federal government if that were to get to be the case? And, you know, for many, many years now, being in Springfield, Illinois, spending a lot of time there, there is a prevailing thought in Illinois, similar to MMT at the federal level, that we may never have to tackle our problems and somebody will just come and bail us out. And in this era of $27 trillion and counting of federal debt, I think it's safe to say that the federal government is not in much of a position to bail out a state like Illinois. But I do think that's a discussion, especially if we don't see strong economic growth in the future, that we will be having because of these massive unfunded liabilities and promises, many cases to the public sector for benefits that the private sector employees do not have.
Yeah, I think my own state, I think our unfunded pension liabilities are hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, and we're not alone. As you mentioned, Illinois, New York, New Jersey, other states are like it. You have to wonder, Jonathan, when this comes to a head. In other words, you know, back in the 70s when we were running budget deficits at the federal level, there was a group of investors called bond vigilantes, and they would discipline governments with their policies. They seem to be absent with inflation. What would happen if inflation returns? I mean, when you take a look at economically, we are reducing the output of services, we're reducing the output of goods, but at the same time, we're cutting checks to people to buy the same level of goods and services when those have been restricted. I can't help but believe that prices are heading higher.
Right. And of course, what does that mean for debt payments on existing debt? I mean, that gets pretty scary pretty quickly in terms of what that would mean for an outlay at the federal level to finance $27 trillion in national debt. The other dynamic that you have here is, dynamic when it comes to pensions and interest rates and return on investment. This has been a big change in the portfolios across the state pension funds over time. And as you know well in this space, back in the 80s, you could go into treasuries and hit your assumed rate of return no problem and probably have excess investment return to spare when it comes to state pensions. They were all kind of relatively conservative on the investment side because of that reason. Fast forward, many of the state pension systems tried to chase returns on equities in the 90s, and many of them got to the game a little bit late, then suffered the downturn in the tech bust and 9/11 downturns. And now fast forward to today, states have gotten quite aggressive at chasing returns. They're still assuming 7, 7.5, 8% in many cases for the future on what they think they're going to earn. Of course, those are defined benefit pension payouts. So they're using pretty aggressive assumptions on return for a what essentially is a defined benefit payout to employees. And yet where they used to be able to see 10 or 12 or 14% on treasuries, we know where treasuries are today. And so that dynamic as well, I think, has really shaped the course of how pension investments and pension funding have gotten way out of whack. And of course, the dynamic as well, where we saw the vast majority of private sector firms move to the 401k model and defined contribution pension systems, because after all, private sector firms have to follow real accounting rules under ERISA for those remaining defined benefit pension plans, where in the states, and I hate to open up this can of worms, but I think it's safe to say, If the private sector CEOs or CFOs were signing off on financial statements using the kind of accounting that state and local governments use when it comes to pensions, we'd have them going to prison. It would be what would be happening right now. And that's really a huge issue. And I think that's one of the very existential issues around municipal and state finance going forward as well.
You know, it's surprising, given some of these economic numbers that you're looking at, these huge, massive deficits that states like New York, Illinois, and California are amassing, that the municipal bond market would be reacting to it, but it's been fairly peaceful and calm. I mean, yields on municipals are the lowest they've been in at least my career.
Well, right. Yeah, it's a very interesting point. Interesting also to see the somewhat limited spread between states, given the risk factors of states on their debt between Illinois and, let's say, a AAA bond-rated state. You also have, the issue when it comes to of state finance, when it comes to the CARES Act and what the Federal Reserve is now allowing states to borrow directly from the Fed. Which has, of course, changed things pretty dramatically. There's only been a few states and municipal levels of government that have taken advantage of this, but we're talking below market interest rates that now, I think it was a pool of about $500 billion offered by the Fed as part of the CARES Act coming out of Washington, D.C., that really did now give the states one more lever to use. I mean, it wasn't, enough that states received $200 billion plus in aid from the federal government to cover direct expenses to coronavirus through that aid package. They were also given the municipal finance authority from the Fed at $500 billion. And so adding those things up, you kind of have to ask yourself, why is it that we're having this discussion around an additional bailout of states, given that the federal government has done so much to try to prop up state government as part of this very difficult year that we've all faced?
So given all this, sooner or later, good things come to an end. And so far, the government has been able to issue massive amounts of debt. The Fed is printing money to the tune of $120 billion a month, and there's been no negative consequences. Interest rates remain low. Mortgage rates are low. The rates on bond markets, whether you're looking at sovereigns or corporates, all remain low. We've been in this downtrend for almost 40 years of declining interest rates and low inflation. I just wonder at what point, given the economic circumstances, that this reverses and we start going in the opposite direction as we did in the 70s.
Well, I mean, I wish I had a great answer for that. If I had that crystal ball and would be able to tell you that point, I'll tell you what, I may be doing something slightly different than I'm doing right now. But, you know, that is a great question. And we're also kind of we're pushing that limit, right? And we are now, when you look at the national debt clock, which I always, if you're feeling a pessimistic day, you know, check out that U.S. Debt clock and, you know, pushing that 27 trillion number. And depending on some proposals that are floating still in Congress, so we could be at 30 trillion by the end of the year. Let's hope not. But you know, I think we are continuing to push that limit on where we can really have that level of debt carry that without severe consequences. Right, people have been kind of raising the siren for some time on that issue, and we just haven't seen it yet. I just would not want to be the person at the controls when that does move in the wrong direction.
Well, listen, as we close, Jonathan, how can our listeners get a hold of your report on the states? And this is very, very useful as a lot of people are contemplating making a move, whether for COVID reasons, economic reasons, or maybe they're getting ready to retire and want to live in a place that's less expensive. You guys really get into state by state all these criteria, which would give, you know, a potential person considering a move some great information.
Well, we've got some great free information. ALEC.org, that's ALEC.org, has the Rich States, Poor States report, as well as our report analyzing America's governors. That's brand new in lots of different ways that we look at these 50 laboratories of democracy, because at the end of the day, we have very different models of government out there, and that's a strength to our American system of federalism. And so people can certainly take advantage of this treasure trove of information and all our research.
Well, listen, Jonathan, as always, thanks for being on the program, and I hope to speak with you again in the future.
Well, thanks so much for having me on, and look forward to rejoining you once again.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.